This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio on this Monday, May 20th. I'm Chris Nolte, and we continue our conversations with members of Northwest Indiana's legislative delegation today with State Senator Karen Talion. She's a Democrat who represents residents along Lake Michigan. Before we get into your assessment of how the session went in general, let's talk about some of the measures that you had coming up here. You had introduced a number of them, and a lot of them got to at least to be referred to committee and all, but bring us up to date on some of the ones in particular, and there's some major ones in particular that deal with property that's along Lake Michigan. Tell us that measure that you offered up. Senate Bill 553 is the number for it, if people want to look up the number and see it in more detail. But tell us how the background about that, little backstory, and how things stand on the issue.
I can tell you that one. All right, so most of the places along we have about 40 miles of lakeshore in Indiana, and most of the places I have pretty well-defined property rights. However, there was a situation in one of the towns, Long Beach, where the north property line was not defined. I mean, this dates back a century. And so somewhere along the line, they had a fight about, well, do I own to the high water mark? Do I own to the beach? Do I own, to the water's edge, wherever it may be? And this has been floating around there for several years. About 5 years ago, I had a bill that would just settle the question. And the bill went through the Senate and said, we're gonna call it the high water mark, and that'll be the property line, and that's how we'll define it. Got through the Senate, went over to the House, and then there was a lawsuit filed, and the lawsuit went through every court, the trial court, the Court of Appeals, and finally the Indiana Supreme Court. And you know what they all said?
What?
They all ended up saying that the property line should be the high water mark, which might have been avoided, but avoided 5 years of litigation. But in any case, we now have a ruling from the Indiana Supreme Court that says the property line is the high water mark and the beaches are held in trust for the public, for public use and enjoyment. So we ended up with two questions. First of all, how do we know where the high water mark is? And the second is, what do we mean by public use and enjoyment? So the first one was pretty well defined. We got that pretty well fixed about how you determine where the high water mark is. But then there was a question about what does public use and enjoyment mean? And there were a small group of people in Long Beach who just had a fit about this. Mm-hmm. They wanted public use and enjoyment to just mean you walk past my house, but you don't sit down. You keep on going. And to me, that was pretty outrageous. The beaches belong to the public. And so I had a bill that was going to codify what that meant, which meant what we've always used our beaches for, which is, go fishing, go swimming, go have a picnic, sit down, play Frisbee, whatever. And it made it through the Senate. But it did not make it through the House of Representatives. So that's where we are. And I know a lot of people were unhappy that it didn't make it through, but the way I see it, I was going to codify something that the Supreme Court had already decided. So as far as I'm concerned, we've got a Supreme Court case. And the people who were fighting this have nothing.
It happens that way. That's the way that lawsuits sometimes work out. And in this case, that's the way that sometimes legislation works out too, right?
Yeah, that's unfortunately the case.
I know a lot of people were very, very upset about this when the bill was introduced, I guess supported by some other members of the legislature to make the changes to try to keep this keep the beaches basically semi-public and maybe more private than public in some places, depending on who happens to own the property. And we know that representatives from cities around the region that have homes or certainly have property along the lakefront, places like the city of Gary, for example. You've got the Marquette Park all through there. They would be affected by all this, and a lot of other places I know all along, even to the east of you, would be affected by this. And they, I guess, worked very hard. And the Save the Dunes organization worked as well, too, to make sure that the measure didn't pass, did they?
No, that's right. We had a lot of people supporting this. There, unfortunately, a small group managed to kind of put a monkey wrench in the gears, and you know, we're going to either have to keep trying or we'll just let it be and hope that these fights, I mean, most of these fights, you know, just have only happened in a couple of small places.
Mm-hmm.
And mostly we've been able to get along, so that's what I'm hoping will happen.
The 2019 session is history with closing out. First, let's get your overall assessment of how the session went, and then we can focus in, too, if you like, on how the two-year state budget, which we're now into or will be very soon, has going to have impact on Hoosiers all across the state.
Well, there were a number of interesting bills this year, and then there were a number of bills that we spent incredible amounts of time on, and then, you know, ended up that all the work that everybody had done for 2-3 months ended up being changed or forgotten in the last 5 days.
Uh-huh.
So let me talk a little bit about Department of Children and Family Services. We have known that this has been an issue for years. It's just been an issue. Nobody can quite get it right. Either people are the administrative group, DCS, is either too lax with people or too strict with people. And the pendulum has swung to the too strict situation, and we have had more out-of-home placements than almost anybody else around. Our DCS numbers of out-of-home placements are just over the top. And we have known that DCS needed more money for caseworkers, but we also needed to feel that we could marry that with some structural changes in the way DCS does business. So there was a bipartisan group in the Senate, at least, and we had several attorneys, we had DCS, we had the prosecutors and the public defenders, and all of these people working on a whole range of items that would say, all right, DCS, we're going to give you more money, but in exchange, you're going to do the following things. You're going to make public defenders available to families early and require early mediation, you know, or kind of settlement conference, if you will, before you pull kids out of the house, unless mm-hmm. it's an absolute crisis, of course. And we spent weeks working on a format, and this is what we would do, and this is how it was going to be done. And in the end, it was so frustrating and disappointing, not just to me, but I know Republicans felt this way as well, that a couple of people who were writing the budget just got rid of about three quarters of what we had all agreed to. And unfortunately, this is the way that a lot of bills ended up. You know, you get people coming up with agreed solutions, and then somebody somewhere, and I'm sure that in this particular case, it was DCS itself who said, okay, we'll take the part we like and get, you know, made a major push to get rid of the part that they didn't like. So that was one of the frustrations of session. And, of course, a lot of these things end up in the budget.
So you've got the problems that you deal with there, too. And I know that not everybody's very happy with the two-year budget that's now been passed.
No, that's right. And, you know, we worked hard. So we had two new people running the budget. You know, we in the House, we had Todd Houston, who had taken over for Representative Brown, who had been in a serious car accident and just couldn't, you know, he came back, but he wasn't quite up to doing the budget job. So we had, if you will, a rookie in the House, and in the same thing in the Senate. Last budget had been done by Senator Luke Kenley, who'd been working on budgets for 20 years, and now we've got Senator Mishler, who this was his first budget year. And in the end, I think there was a lot of, you know, they sort of got to a place, I feel like, where they didn't know what to do next, and so they just, when they didn't know what to do about it, they took it out.
That the governor didn't help any either, I would imagine, especially when it matters having additional funding to NDOT to help keep the Hoosier State passenger rail service alive. That money wasn't put in the budget for the start of the session, and then, of course, never ended up in the budget. Now they go into the new budget cycle with no funding and keep the trains going between Chicago and Indianapolis.
That's right, and there were a lot of things. You know, it's very disappointing to me that they had this idea in their mind that they wanted to keep a surplus of $2 billion. Well, they ended up with a surplus of like $2 billion plus $8 million.
Mm-hmm.
Well, do you know how many little things could have been funded with just that budget leftover of $8 million? I mean, there are all kinds of projects that cost $50,000 or $20,000 or $100,000 that could have been funded. And then, of course, there is nothing magic about the number $2 billion. You know, that's a number that they just come up with out of nothing.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't need that number. We could have taken another about $300 million out of that and still have been funded to a good percentage of our operating. No, there were a lot of people very unhappy about this.
Do you think that in the case of these measures, and in particular what happened to the DCS measure that you all had worked so hard on through the session, do you think there's a chance that you may have to bring some of this back up in the next session and try and, hate to start all over, but at least be able to pick up and where you left off and try and get some passage maybe next year, or maybe will it end up going to a summer or fall study conference committee?
There are some things that we could legislate. Especially, for example, on the DCS stuff, there are some things that we could just legislate that don't have to be in the budget. But it's kind of, you know, we almost never, during the short session, we almost never do a reopener on the budget. It's because once you do that, then everybody wants to do that. So it's kind of an unwritten rule. We don't open the budget and redo budgetary items in the off year.
So you feel that maybe
we might pass some legislation, but people are going to be without money.
So you think that maybe there might be some provisions of what you had all had worked on involving the Department of Child Services that might be able to put into place here without having to mess around with the budget?
Yes. Yes, and we'll probably be offering some of those.
Well, it sounds like, Aaron, a lot of things to bring up here going into the 2020 session, to be sure. 2019 session, some successes and some failures, and it sounds like in everybody's part in one way or the other, it sounds like. And we appreciate you spending some time to go over in great detail about the ones that you had most concern on, of course, here in Northwest Indiana and in general around the Hoosier State. And we hope to have a chance to talk with you again, to talk in more detail about these issues. And we hope that the 2020 session works out better for everybody this time around.
Well, I hope that's true. Yeah, and I'd love to talk to you a little more about some of the, you know, kind of in the weeds stuff about how we could have funded a better teacher raise without raising taxes, without you know, without using up new money.
That's what Regionally Speaking is for. We have the opportunity and we have the time during the program to be able to bring a little more detail about some of these topics, and we'll certainly have the door open for you to come back and join us again soon, Karen.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. We've been talking with State Senator Karen Talion. She's a Democrat representing sections of Northwest Indiana. And a point of full disclosure, by the way, Karen Talion is a member of Lakeshore Public Media's Board of Directors. You're listening to Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio. Let's continue talking with some of the folks who have won in the primary election for mayor around Northwest Indiana. And we're going now to Valparaiso, where Democrat Bill Durnell has defeated Deb Porter to become the candidate on the Democratic Party ticket to go up against Republican Matt Murray, who in turn, as a Republican, is trying to succeed incumbent mayor and now retiring mayor John Costas. Thank you very much, Bill, for being with us here on Regionally Speaking today.
Oh, thank you, Chris. It's
well,
my pleasure.
Let's first get a quick reaction to what you feel would be a very busy campaign since you had to go up against what seems to be a rather worthy opponent.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I jumped into the race the day before the filing deadline, so we had a whirlwind of 3 months of campaigning, and, you know, we worked really hard. And that showed up in the polls with a 16-point margin Tuesday night.
Well, you know, it's interesting you should mention that because that was exactly the same way as what happened in the city of Gary. Jerome Prince, the Lake County assessor, jumped in just before the filing deadline as well to run for mayor in his city. And he turned out to be the gentleman who was going on in November to the general election there, too, and defeating an incumbent.
Yeah, I didn't watch that race closely, but I had some friends at our watch party who were keeping an eye on both, and I was getting updates on Jerome's race there. So, you know, I think it may be emblematic that voters are ready for some new ideas.
Let's take time now and talk about some of the issues that you brought up in your campaign as you went up against Deb in the primary election. Since you say that you are an agent for change in the city of Valparaiso, what would you like to see happen?
Well, let me start off by saying that we've had a really great leader in John Costas for the last 16 years, and I fully acknowledge his accomplishments and acknowledge that we're also going in the right direction. My issue is that John's successor in the Republican Party does not have some of the same qualities that John does, and so I think it's really important that we can honor what's working well, but also open up our city to new ideas. So just for an example, one of the four legs of my platform is to be a lot more transparent about our long-term financial situation, as well as the way that our business dealings come together.
Do you think that there is an, I would not call it a problem, but do you think that there are just concerns that residents in Valparaiso have about how the city's finances have been handled, which is a matter that would come up not only before the mayor, but also the city council?
Right. No, my criticism is not only with the mayor. It's also with the council. You know, the issue with Valparaiso's finances, and this goes for all cities, really, it's an issue of long-term liabilities. So, for example, when we annex a plot of land for development, I believe statute requires that you only do like a 3 or 4 year impact study. But we know that when we assume new infrastructure, we also assume the responsibility to replace it decades down the road. So we just don't have a good way of keeping track of those long term liabilities. I recently met with a department head in City Hall who estimated that we're $10 to $20 million in deferred maintenance behind. So those are the kinds of things that I think the public needs to understand, and I'm certainly committed to making that more clear.
Does this primarily deal with a question about equipment that's owned by the city rather than roads and streets, or does that include the condition of the roads and streets as well?
It's roads and streets and sidewalks and equipment and parks and I think all of the above, really. I mean, I know that we're paving 10 miles of roads in Valpo this year. I think we have 162 miles of roads, so we're adding to it when we annex properties and assume new infrastructure. So roads are certainly important, but it goes well beyond that.
if you're elected mayor in November, that you'll be able to be able to help push this along a bit. You get to work with not only council members, but you'll have access working with your administration staff to be able to get with NDOT and the other agencies that to have control over more money to be able to get more roads done.
I sure hope so. But what I'm trying to do with the transparency angle is just make it clear. You know, we got to start with understanding how far behind we are. And then we can prioritize and seek funding from within, you know, our city budget as well as across agencies.
What are your feelings about economic development to bring more businesses and industry into the city of Valparaiso?
I'm glad you brought that up, Chris. That is one of my other legs in my platform is the manner in which we develop economically. You know, the strategy of the past has been what I call elephant hunting, mm-hmm. where we try to go out lure outside businesses to come with tax incentives and other sweeteners. However, I am much more committed to an incremental path where we seek to start and grow businesses from within Valparaiso, where the owners actually live in the town, and therefore the value that we create, you know, stays in town and recirculates throughout our local economy.
So you're not finding at fault companies like Pratt Industries, who have come in and expanded greatly in Valparaiso, but you'd like to see more homegrown businesses, as you say, to grow and to expand.
Pratt is a good example of one that worked out. However, economic development is inherently a risky business, so we can go through the list of those mm-hmm. that didn't work out so well.
Let's find out your views here on transit. In particular, you've got the V line, and you've got great service in Valparaiso. And we know now that the South Shore line is going to be doing its expansion eventually along the line there north of you. What would you like to see in the city of Valparaiso in the years ahead, if you're elected mayor, to be able to better link passengers and opportunities for business along that route?
You know, transit's a big portion of any city, especially intra-city transit. You know, you mentioned the V-Line, which is a good service we offer. The Chicago Dash bus is a bus that I used to ride when I worked in Chicago, commuting from Valparaiso. That's a great service as well. Rail service, you know, I'm not holding my breath. It's going to be decades probably before that happens. And by that time, you know, this technology may catch up and make the trains obsolete because everybody will be working from home. Who knows?
That's very, very possible. I know that there's talk about high-speed rail connection between Chicago and even Fort Wayne that would end branches even to the east here. And eventually, I think Valparaiso would be concluded in one of the stops.
Well, that would be great because my family's from Fort Wayne, so I'd have an easy way to get out mm-hmm. there. Again, my concern with those services you mentioned is that they're heavily subsidized by federal grants. And I am always, whenever we talk about federal monies, I am always a little nervous about its sustainability. So, you know, I'm going to look for ways to shore up our transit services from within and not rely so much on outside money.
Well, you had a chance to find out some of the planks in your campaign platform that you ran on during the primary election. Are you pretty much going to stay the course, or are some other new ideas in the works as you follow through to the election in November?
Absolutely. You know, I was elected to be the nominee, and I have a slate of 8 other Democratic office seekers. And so we're going to go through a process of linking up our platforms and starting to talk about things in a slightly different way. Core of my platform will remain.
Bill Durnell, who is the Democratic Party mayoral candidate in the city of Valparaiso, he's going to be facing a Republican challenger, Matt Murray, who is in turn going to be trying to follow in the footsteps, in a way, of longtime incumbent mayor John Costas. Bill, thank you for joining us today, and we hope to have a chance to catch you further down the trail in the campaign trail between now and November.
I certainly appreciate it, Chris. Thank you.
A lot of things happening these days at the South Shore Line. Things that are happening as far as construction projects are concerned, and also what's coming ahead on 2 major projects here in Northwest Indiana. With us to talk about it, we have President CEO of NICTI, which is, of course, the Northern Indiana Commuter Transportation District, which is the operator of the South Shore Line. Mike Noland with us. Mike, thanks for joining us on Regionally Speaking.
Thanks, Chris. Always happy to be here.
Well, glad to find out from you some of the latest that's happening. Let's start first with the big construction project that's underway. It's really a expansion project, for I understand one of the South Shore Line's biggest and busiest stations. Tell us what's happening in East Chicago these days.
Yeah, Chris, we're really excited. A couple of years ago, we applied for a grant from the Federal Railroad Administration to really address a situation in East Chicago that's been known to us from the beginning. We have one ingress and egress into the station. And years ago, when we built the station, it was very expensive, and we only had enough funding to build that single entrance. But we've had always had on the drawing board the planning folks to put a second entrance in, and we applied for some federal funding, and we were awarded a Federal Railroad Administration grant a couple years ago, and so we're starting the project now to build a second entranceway to the east of the current head house, so that our riders have another opportunity to get up and down from the platform. And given the fact you mentioned it's our busiest station by far, it can get very crowded and take a long time to especially when a train comes in, because everybody unloads all at the same time. So that's really going to help the comfort and the safety and the accessibility for that station.
Now, we know that people typically take the one entrance and exit that's now been there now all along. What was the expansion project going to be like, and how can people get in and get off the trains when you're all finished?
Sure. Basically, it's about 100 feet to 150 feet to the west of the current stair system. There'll be a second stair system that you can access from the parking lots and go up to the platform. You'll come up to a low-level platform that will be covered, and you'll then walk from that area to the west till you get to the high-level platform, and you can then board your train from there. So it'll really give our folks much greater access to and from the train. And at night, a lot of our riders want to be the first one off the train to get out of the parking lot. And so this is going to spread out the access points from the train. So we're really excited to provide this new improvement to the system.
Well, I know I've taken family members to the East Chicago station to catch a train going eastbound. And we've had not only a long wait sometimes, waiting to either get on the train in some cases, or actually waiting for everybody to get off that have come over from the Chicago. And they're going to get, as you say, get there to that parking lot to get to their cars and head on out. So this will definitely be a big help. What's the timetable for the project right now?
It's really a two-phase project. The first phase is to construct a second entrance, and that should be done by November or December of this year. The second phase of this project actually involves an improvement to the operations. As we come into the station, we divert off the tracks. We build a second track in. It's called the Gauntlet Track. And we approach the station, and we depart the station at about 15 miles an hour, and we divert the freights around the platforms, and they stay at 35 miles an hour. We're going to then switch that around so that the quicker move is into the platform by adding some improvements to the physical plant, mm-hmm. and it'll decrease the travel time by making that improvement by about a minute or a minute and a half. We'll start that project next spring. So it's really a twofold project that we're working on. One is to improve the ingress and egress to the station, and the other is an operational improvement to decrease the travel time that will benefit all riders in the system.
Now, what is the note that we pass along to commuters, people that ride the trains on a regular basis, or people waiting to meet people that are coming over on the train? What should they know about the parking lot especially and about the access because of all this work?
Yeah, before we began the improvement, because we knew we were going to have to take some spaces out of the lot, Chris, for construction, we actually restriped a portion of the lot, and we picked up some spaces. So there's no net loss of parking spaces, because East Chicago can get at capacity at times. Mm-hmm. So we were able to pick up some additional spots by restriping the lot, and so we're really at a net zero as far as the loss from the area where the construction zone is. But there is a construction zone, so folks who are coming from the eastern portion of the lot, just allow yourself an extra minute or two every day, because you're going to have to walk around that construction zone to get into the platform.
We're talking with Mike Nolan, who's the chief executive for the South Shore Line, about the work that is currently being done with the expansion and some reworking there at the East Chicago station, one of, if not the, South Shore Line's busiest train station these days. Also, too, let's get caught up here, Mike, on the two major projects. We know that the General Assembly finished up the legislative session with some additional funds available, so this way you get some assurance that you have some backup or at least a little padding in the budgets. In turn, hopefully, that the federal funding is going to come through as it should. What's the latest we can pass along on the not only the double tracking, which is, I know, the big major work on the line, but also the new West Corridor line?
Sure, Chris. Yeah, we're really excited. Basically, what the state did was make sure that we have the capacity that the federal government's going to require to move these projects forward. And essentially, the federal government's going to want to see that you've got sufficient contingency above your project budget so that they feel comfortable that you can go forward and fund these projects. And the state, with the $205 million that they passed this last session, gives us that flexibility and positions us to move both the Westlake Corridor and the Double Track projects forward. Mm-hmm. So we are really excited. It puts us in a position of competitiveness with other projects around the country, really elevates our standing with the FTA. It's very, very exciting, and it once again shows the commitment that this state has towards these projects, and that speaks volumes to our federal partners as they evaluate our programs and as we move them forward. And so we are now moving full speed ahead on Westlake and Double Track. We're about to take our financing plan to RDA and IFA's board, Indiana Finance Authority's board, and then get it to the State Budget Committee so we can submit Double Track to the feds so both projects can get in the federal pipeline to get that all-important federal matching grant to move these projects into construction.
I know that this is mostly relying on the communities along the line, like Gary and like Hammond and East Chicago, to a point. But what will this mean for all the work that the communities want to do to be able to get set up with the opportunities for economic development around the line in particular, the transit-oriented development, as I know is officially called?
Sure. You know, and that's the private sector portion of this, which is really great. The cities are really doing a phenomenal job to position themselves from a planning standpoint. There's a lot of work that's being done on the transit development districts through the RDA, through their local comprehensive plan updates that the communities are doing. But when the private developers see this additional funding coming from the state, it just sends such a powerful message about the commitment that the state and the locals have to bring these projects forward, that I think really provides more incentive for the private sector because they see that this is going to get done, and we are full speed ahead on making sure that these construction projects happen, which gives the confidence to those who are going to invest in these communities from a private sector standpoint, which is what's going to dictate success. From the railroad standpoint, we want to build the railroad. From the city standpoint, you want to make sure that the planning and the opportunities are there to promote the development. Then you need the private sector to step forward, mm-hmm. and we've really sent a real positive message to that private sector development community that these projects are going to happen.
Now, so far, even though it is early in the game, so to speak, have you had any information requests coming in from developers asking just in general more information about the project and so they can kind of plan for what these TOD projects might be like?
You know, from the rail standpoint, we see it, but we're one step removed. We are hearing those things, but we're not directly involved in that. What we have seen, Chris, is that we just had a open house for the contractors for the Westlake project. That's going to be a $450 to $500 million construction contract. And we had two events, one here at our Dune Park offices and a second event at the Hammond Recreational Center. And we were standing room only from the construction community, with lots of different construction firms, engineering firms who are chomping at the bit to get going to build these projects. So that in and of itself is an economic shot in the arm. We know, though, that the RDA and the communities are experiencing direct conversations with developers who are in the planning stages to jump on the opportunity as soon as they can once they know these projects are under construction.
Okay. Well, finally, finally, Mike, let me check in with you on one interesting topic that has come up here. It happened about the same time, of course, that the General Assembly wrapped up its work for the year. We know about the latest on what we have done to help smooth things along in getting the double tracking and the Westlake Corridor project funding more solidified, I suppose. But I know there was one concern that came up because of a decision that was made in Indianapolis about changing the makeup of the NICTI board. Tell us about that and what kind of impact, if any, that's going to have on the projects.
Well, there's no doubt that when you change a board and when there's that kind of high level change, there's certainly some disappointed board members who've served the current NICTI board with passion and with pride, and I think that they're definitely disappointed that change has been made. They're to a member extremely excited about the fact that the state stepped up with the money. It's absolutely critical to them to see these projects go forward, and I think they would have liked to have been part of it. And some of them may be, because the governor still is in the process of making his appointments to the reconstituted NICTI board. Now, the chair will be the commissioner of the Indiana Department of Transportation, which to me is wonderful to get NDOT directly involved in our operations. And then we're going to have a member, an elected official from each of the four counties. So there will still be representation from the four counties, and we await the appointments anxiously to see who that's going to be. And mm-hmm. It could be that some of my current board members are on this new board. And so it's changed, but you know what? We are a creature of the state, they have the power to make those kind of decisions. And frankly, the state's putting in over $600 million in capital funding to these projects and provides most of, if not all, of our local financial taxpayer support comes from the state. So the state's got a lot of vested interest in this, and I think that the reorganization is reflected in that decision.
Well, Mike, thank you very much for the updates on the projects here, and we'll hope to find out more as things develop here, and we appreciate you spending some time with us today to talk about them.
All right, Chris. Always great to talk to you.
Nice talk with you. Mike Noland is the chief executive for the Northern Indiana Public Transportation District, also known as the operator of the South Shore Line. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. There's now a book out about sports broadcaster Harry Carey that goes beyond his Cubs years. The legendary Harry Carey, baseball's greatest salesman, was written by Don Zmita. And Lakeshore Public Radio Sharon Jackson talked with Zmita about things that weren't widely known about that legendary broadcaster.
You wrote this book, The Legendary Harry Carey, Baseball's Greatest Salesman. Why did you write it?
Harry is a pretty famous person in the broadcasting field. He died in 1998. He's in no danger of being forgotten. There's a statue of him outside of Wrigley Field, the Cubs ballpark in Chicago. When the Cubs play the seventh inning stretch song, Take Me Out to the Ball Game, that Harry made famous by leading the crowd, they often just show a video of him leading the crowd. I felt that he is now remembered mostly for his Cub years when he was a kind of grandfatherly figure. And he also becomes something of a figure of fun. There were Will Ferrell imitations of him. He mangled names toward the end of his career. He forgot things. That really wasn't the whole Harry. That really wasn't the best Harry. He broadcast for over 50 years. He broadcast significantly for three major league teams, the Cardinals and the White Sox, as well as the Cubs. Those stories are equally fascinating as his Cub years are. And also his own personal story is almost Dickensian. It's a fascinating story. I really wanted to put the whole Harry into perspective and to tell his complete life story.
So if you could give me a Cliff Notes version of what people don't talk about, what they don't remember, and what you wanted them to know about those early years. Why is that? Why do you think they remember those later years and not those early years?
Toward the end of his years with the Cubs in particular, he became a national cable TV star. WGN, which is the Cubs' home station, was able to be broadcast throughout the country. So people everywhere in America could watch Cub games on a daily basis and watch and listen to Harry. He became so famous that he appeared on shows like David Letterman. He actually led the Democratic delegates at the 1996 convention in Chicago and singing Take Me Out to the Ball Game. He sang that song with Robert Merrill of the New York Opera. He was just a legendary figure, but that fame was so great that I really think that the rest of the story is in danger of being forgotten a little bit.
So what do you think people should know?
First of all, his personal story. He was born in 1914, which is the year that World War I started. He never knew his father. His father went away to World War I, was an immigrant from Europe, actually probably born in Albania, although I think his heritage was Italian. Harry really never knew his father because his father never came back from World War I. Harry didn't know whether he died or lived. There's still a mystery about that because all record of him has disappeared. He was raised by his mother, who was also a European immigrant and very poor. His mother became seriously ill. She remarried when Harry was an adolescent, but then died 2 years later. He was raised by a paternal uncle and his aunt, and then the uncle left. So Harry really had a very difficult childhood, had a lot to overcome in his life. It really affected his private life a lot. Publicly, he was this outgoing, personable guy, friend of everyone, could connect with strangers easily. Privately, with his own family, he had much more difficulty. In the book, I talked at some length with both his widow, Duchy, and with his grandson, Chip, who is also a broadcaster, now works for the Atlanta Braves. And Chip kind of put it in perspective when he said, Harry never had trouble being Harry. He had a lot of trouble being dad or grandfather. But toward the end of his life, he was really able to warm up to and connect with his own family to a significant degree. Almost became a different person by the time that he died in his 80s.
And that charisma, what do you think made him so fascinating to people?
Well, Harry always said that he felt like he was the voice of the fans and that he considered himself a fan behind the mic. And not so much in his Cub years, but especially during his White Sox and Cardinal years, he was completely unfiltered about expressing his opinions about what was happening on the field. If he felt the player wasn't hustling or playing well, Harry would openly criticize him. If he was feeling that the management of the team wasn't doing enough to make the team better, he would express his opinions on the air. And that really became something that made him beloved to fans because they felt that he was their voice. There's an incident in the book where the White Sox were finishing a very dismal year when Harry was broadcasting for him. The last game of the season, instead of broadcasting the game, he went down into the stands during the last three innings and just interviewed fans and said, what do you think about this team? How do you think they're going to improve? What do you feel about them now and about next year? And he really gave voice to their own opinions. That's something that Harry was absolutely brilliant at.
You wrote the book because you wanted these stories to be told.
I did. And also, I was a Chicago boy. And I have to tell you that I have been a White Sox lifelong fan, really, from the time that I started following baseball in the 1950s. And a big story in the book and a big part of Harry's own story in broadcasting was that after spending 11 years with the White Sox, he switched to the Cubs and became much more famous and popular with the Cubs than he ever was with the White Sox, in part because of the whole Wrigley Field persona and also especially because the Cubs were such a nationally known team by being broadcast coast to coast. I felt that his White Sox years, which were equally compelling, were being left a little bit in the background. Those years were simply fascinating. The White Sox often had a bad team. Harry was totally unafraid to criticize the players and even the management. He called his own owner an idiot because he felt that the owner wasn't doing enough to improve the team. And those years were so interesting and compelling that I really felt that that part of the story should be told equally as much as the Cubs story was.
So was he not open and opinionated and the voice of the fans when he was the Cubs broadcaster?
He was still, but not to the degree that he was with the White Sox. I think that there's documentation that I talk about in the book that when he moved to the Cubs management kind of quietly called him aside and said, Harry, we want you to be honest. We don't yet want you to be afraid to criticize players when they do something wrong, but you really have to get out of attacking people personally. And the management of the team was pretty much off limits as far as criticism was concerned. Not completely, but certainly not to the degree that was the case with the White Sox. And also, he was older. He was so popular. He was having fun broadcasting the games. And also in his personal life, as I mentioned before, he was a happier person. I think he didn't have the sort of edge that he had during his White Sox years and during his Cardinal years as well.
I read, anyway, that he was deathly afraid of cows, but he kind of coined the phrase, holy cow, made it famous. How did you come upon that little fact?
Well, as Harry became kind of a national celebrity with the Cubs, he started getting offers for commercial products. And there was a soft drink company in the Chicago area that wanted to market a soft drink called Holy Cow. And they were going to have Harry's picture on the containers. And as part of the opening launch of the product, they decided that it would be fun to show Harry with a cow and have him kind of walking a few steps and leading the cow by the rope. The Chicago media person that I talked to that was working on that promotion said Harry was so afraid of cows that he wouldn't come anywhere near it. And so that promotional project kind of fell flat, and the soft drink ultimately was not very successful.
You can hear more of this conversation on our website at lakeshorepublicradio.org. And with another edition of Eye on the Arts, here's John Kane with South Shore Arts.
Joining me for this edition of Eye on the Arts are Patricia Cummings, board president, and Jane Lohmeyer, the founding director of All About Art Camp in Valparaiso. And Jane, you have been here in the past to talk about the camp that you brought Patricia, who is also one of the teachers.
Yes, I am.
So let's talk about what happens. First of all, how long has All About Art Camp been in existence?
We started it 17 years ago. The professors and Professor Brower, Professor Fry, wanted a camp to can go in conjunction with the art museum at the university. And so our camp is integral with the museum. We have field trips to the museum, and so it's a lot of fun for the kids to get really involved with master's art and in their own art to inspire them.
Where is the camp held?
It's at Valparaiso University in the Art Psych Building, and we have we also have field trips that go out to the Hot Shop in Valparaiso, and we have a plein air art opportunity for the kids at Rogers Lakewood, so it's different places.
Is the Hot Shop, that's the glass blowing?
Yes.
Yes.
They blow glass and they show us how, and it's really fun.
We've had our Eye on the Arts television segments featuring that
they
group.
Do wonderful things there.
So how did it all, Jane, you got it started. How did that come about?
There is a VU grad who is actually a contemporary of mine who had started something similar in Iowa, I believe it was, and she presented her ideas to Professor Fry and Professor Brower, and she was invited onto campus then to give a presentation to Patricia and I and Jody Nix, who also helped to co-found the art camp.
Mm-hmm. How many? What age groups are involved? What ages are involved?
This year we're starting at first grade until high school, and actually there's a we're having an adult camp as well this year, so it goes all the way up.
We have that the first?
A new one we have. It's a new camp. It's for fiber arts, and that has high school through adult. Our special needs camp is also through adults, so it starts whenever, you know, you want to come for and go all the way through adults. We also have a parent night, which is and grandparent night, so that's on the last Wednesday of the camp, and so that's a lot of fun too with all different ages.
So how many camps are there?
We have one, two,
a lot of camps.
Three, four, five, six.
I thought it was one camp all these years.
No, we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. How many do we
have? Well,
we
don't have to. Nobody's.
Six camps.
It's not a quiz. It's okay.
Okay.
But there's several camps is the point.
Seven camps. We have seven. Yes,
not
seven camps.
Several, seven.
Yes.
Okay. Well, and how long is each camp?
Most of the camps are 3 hours, but the special needs and the fiber arts is 1.5 hours.
How many days, though? I mean, do they run or how many weeks do they run?
We run 2 weeks starting June 17th. Through June 28th, and so June 17th through June 28th, but most they're all 1 week at a time, so it's
because that's a lot going on at once. How do you keep it all? How do you
we have
remember
a lot of
teachers?
That's the thing. We have a lot of teachers. We do morning and afternoon, and then some in the evening.
So, how many people are you serving with all of these camps? That's
around 125.
Wow.
100.
Well, that's fantastic.
That's really fun. We love it.
And so is the Brower's collection kind of like the centerpiece of the camp?
pretty much we like to include, like this year we're going to have an emphasis on, we have a, I'm a storyteller, and we're going to have, I'm going to dress up like a person that's an artist. And so we're doing the Impressionist exhibit, or the Impressionist emphasis this year. Mm-hmm. And so the Brower helps us with that when mm-hmm. they do our, when we do our field trips over there.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Well, it sounds great. How do people find out about it, and how do you enroll?
We have a website. It's www.allaboutart@vu.org. We could also call Jane Lohmeyer, our
your founder.
Yes. Or any of the art teachers. So, and we give out brochures for that.
Okay, great. Well, so the website, though, is the best place to go to get most of the information. Well, ladies, thank you for being here to tell us about the camps. So many.
It's fun to be here.
And thank you for listening. We'll be back again next week with another edition of Eye on the Arts.
You can hear this conversation and previous editions of Eye on the Arts online on our website right now at lakeshorepublicradio.org. And be sure to tune in every Monday here on Regionally Speaking for another Eye on the Arts conversation here on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks for joining us, and we hope you'll be with us tomorrow.